Americans, whether we live on the land or have never really been away from the asphalt, value wilderness. It's part of our reality, our heritage. It weaves through both our history and our literature, and it seems to be a part of who we are. That being true, America is these days engaged in a very literal struggle with itself over how to preserve and protect the wilderness at the same time as we find a way to remain a part of the wilderness we still have left. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. And my guest today is political scientist Professor James Gladden. Professor Gladden has been studying wilderness and the varying and sometimes conflicted values we hold dear for several years. Jim, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This concept of wilderness is an old English word, comes out of the 11th, 12th century, so it kind of precedes America, but it seems to be a very American concept. When, I guess just to set the stage, when you think about the rest of the world, Africa and Asia and Europe and Australia, do you see wilderness held dear elsewhere, or is it us?
I think it's unique to America. I think in part because of the history of breaking land and moving west. I think it's also in a sense peculiar to us because we're an industrialized society. I think a lot of third world countries in Africa and Asia don't have the same sort of tug or pull toward not developing land. I think that's something that's unique to us, in part because we've gone through so much of our wild land and developed it, and in part because we have a level of richness to enable us to look at these lands and perhaps want to set them aside and preserve them.
Mm-hmm. Is it that confluence of industrialization and a large land mass that created our relationship to wilderness, or something else?
Well, I think that is it in part. We really went through, as Americans, the Industrial Revolution during the 19th century, and I think the term has conquered the land, a sort of rolling battlefield between man and nature, moving to the west and developing land. And again, it seems that the concept of wilderness as a legal idea, setting aside public lands, is something that is unique to America. At least it began here, mm-hmm. The national park idea, and then the 1964 Wilderness Act, which established federal lands as wilderness to be managed for their natural values.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's something that's uniquely American, is this concept of the legal term wilderness, something we set aside. Other places in the world haven't been setting aside, except for as we make the example, yes? Mm-hmm. What about the way we see wilderness? I think what I'm looking for is how do we image this thing? How do we, when we stop and we think, see, I think about Paul Bunyan. Mm-hmm. I think Daniel Boone. I think Abraham Lincoln grew up in a cabin and became president. He literally grew out of the wilderness. Mm-hmm. Is that part of our wilderness heritage too, some sort of an imaging of this term wilderness?
Yeah, I think it is. I think there's a different way to go about getting at that, though. I'm not
Good.
Sure.
You take me where you think we should go.
Well, I think it has to do with just the. I would put it in terms of supply demand, mm-hmm. the notion that there isn't a lot of wild land left, and as a result, the value of the land has grown a lot in that term. I think that there's something in us as a people, much of what we are, in a sense, was defined by the way we interacted with nature and with the wilderness. And so I think there's a certain sense of our past being captured or maybe preserved in a kind of snapshot in wilderness. I think there's some angle to it along that way. I think it's a different sort of cultural value, though, because I think traditionally Americans have looked at wilderness as wasteland, land that isn't being used for its economic value, and so a positive good, a service to society is to develop the land and to use it. And I think we've reached a point in the late 20th century to where our attitudes toward nature and specifically toward wild land are changing quite dramatically, to where, again, because of a lack of supply and a rising demand for recreation and just the idea of preserving areas, there is a shifting sense of what's important.
Does this sense that wilderness is something waiting for us to get our hands on and is something we should, it is appropriate for us to get our hands on and develop, come out of a Western ethic? I mean, if we went to 1491 and asked someone standing on the land, then is this an opportunity waiting to happen? He or she would probably wonder what we're talking about.
I think if you go back far enough, before the Greeks and the Romans, to Paleolithic times, I think that Europeans at that point had an understanding of nature which we don't have in today's world, a pre-industrial, even pre-agricultural period of time. I think that there's been an idea in the West, say coming from someone like John Locke, that nature and human beings are distinct things. Nature is one entity. Human beings are another. Nature is a means toward human ends, whatever that might be, primarily in economic terms. And so I think that traditional focus of Western culture has been on at least since the Greeks and the Romans and the Christians, has been on separating, distancing man from nature, in a sense driving a technological wedge between humans and nature and using nature for whatever ends we decide. I think one thing that's happened is that the so-called environmental movement has come along, and I think it's come along in part because people have gotten concerned about some realization that we are part of nature, that we depend upon nature in a very elemental way. And so if we are disturbing nature, depleting resources, polluting the air, and those kinds of things in a self-interested way, we're putting ourselves at risk. And that doesn't really get into an ethic of the environment, but it does suggest that at least the human race has reached a point of use of the environment and numbers of people that many people believe there ought to be some effort to restrain ourselves relative to the environment.
Can John Locke and an environmentalist, Aldo Leopold, you mentioned to me on the phone the other day, coexist? Can those two people be America?
I think that, I mean, that's an interesting question because it asks whether the basic institutions that we have, the economic institutions, the political institutions, the cultural values, which I think in some broad way come from John Locke, are compatible with a new land ethic. I don't know quite how to respond to that. I think Locke would probably say, if it's in the interest of a nation or the human species to restrict and restrain ourselves in terms of how we use nature, then we ought to do it, but we don't have any sort of shift of ethical focus to say that somehow we have a moral obligation to other life forms or to the biosphere to put any restraints on our behavior except as it relates to our self-interest. I think that Aldo Leopold would disagree with that. I think he's practical. He would say that we ought to restrain ourselves in terms of the use of nature in our own self-interest. But I think Leopold would look at humans as members of a life community. And as a result, we have certain sorts of obligations to restrain ourselves. I don't think that other kinds of life forms have what I would call moral consciousness. I think it's a tendency of all life forms to try and dominate and grow and expand. Mm-hmm. And I think that we as a species have that desire as well. But I think that we also have an intellectual capacity to look into the future and to impose restraints upon ourselves in terms of how we use nature, both in our own interest and, again, I would fashion it in some level of moral concern as well.
Mm-hmm. This is Jim Gladden. He's a professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He holds the position of associate professor and has been with the university since 1985. Are you currently department head with
UNC? Yes, I am.
Yes. Since 91, he's been the department head for the political science department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Jim earned his BA and his PhD from Indiana University at Bloomington. He left and took his master's in between those two from the University of Houston. He is a political scientist and has been working on issues of wilderness values, how we as Americans value wilderness and the conflicts that arise because of that. One of the major studies you've made has been over the Boundary Waters Canoe area in northeastern Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I can't ask you to take years of research and put it into headlines, but I would like to know very briefly what the issues are, because I think it will help our listeners and viewers take a look at how American values are colliding with each other over how we use our wilderness lands and how we define our wilderness lands. So what's happening in the Boundary Waters Canoe area?
Well, I think one issue that is relevant not only to that particular case in Minnesota, but to managing public lands and relating to nature in the lower 48 and certainly to Alaska is the issue of local people and the kind of ways that they want to use public lands that they live near, in some cases on, and a larger population surrounding the local people who have a concern with the land. It seems in many cases that the people who live in the local area, for example, in northeastern Minnesota around the Superior National Forest, want to use the land in a more multiple-use resource development orientation.
In practical terms, that means... I'm sorry, in practical terms, that means what are they doing there?
What they would like to do is, for example, if you're going to have public recreation, you might want to do it in such a way that you could increase the amount of tourist dollars flowing through the local economy, maybe resorts, ski areas, snowmobile trails, fishing operations, etc. It might mean things such as logging, logging land, logging trees for their economic values.
Okay.
It might even mean things like mining or for metal, for ore, or other kinds of things such as fishing, etc.
Okay.
So it's the use of natural resources for economic values. And that's a different kettle of fish than... taking a piece of land and setting it aside pretty much in a natural state, not breaking into it with roads and buildings and clear cuts and various forms of motorized recreation. And I think to a lot of people that's a very difficult thing to understand, especially if they feel that there are certain ways they could use land, for example, motorized recreation, that didn't have an ecological impact. But nonetheless, because of a certain aesthetic on the part of, we'll call them environmentalists, are told they can't use that kind of area as a matter of public law.
This sounds like a forest fire ready to start. Is that what happened in Minnesota?
It led to a lot of controversy. The Boundary Waters in the early 20th century down to 1964 was an area that had quite a lot of multiple use in it. There were established uses in much of the Boundary Waters Canoe area. We're talking about a 1 million acre piece of land, of public land, administered by the Forest Service, and 600,000 of that, the inner core next to the Quetico Provincial Park in Ontario, is basically was never logged, but the outer 400,000 acres was logged fairly extensively, and there were also private inholdings with lodges for recreation and a tradition of motorboat use. And so the effort by some interest groups was to include the boundary waters as part of a new national wilderness preservation system. And that led to a lot of concern on the part of local people because they didn't want these traditional uses, established uses, discontinued. And so they fought against the inclusion of the boundary waters for that purpose.
There's a lot of don't tread on me happening here, isn't there? Besides, I mean, economic interests are important and vital to a people, but well, I'll just ask you to sum it up for me. Is the core of it, don't tread on me, I have a right to use what I stand on?
I think in many respects there is that sense of I'm a local person, I depend upon resources for my income, for my economic life. I don't want people from the outside of the region coming in and telling me what I can and can't do. To me, that leads to an interesting problem because we're talking about federally owned land. We're talking about land owned, in effect, by the Congress or managed through agencies where the Congress decides the use of that land. And so it isn't land owned by a private interest. It's public land. It's not their land. In the case of the folks who, for example, live in Grand Marais, Minnesota, or Ely, Minnesota. And yet there is a proprietary sense of that land because of maybe a number of generations that have grown up in the area and that have hunted and fished and had, in some cases, unrestricted access to the land. And then to have a tightening of or restricting of uses over time is very difficult. I suppose the ideal situation for a wilderness, a legal wilderness, would be to find a place in the public lands that had never been used for any purpose and that didn't have any sort of human use or purpose. And of course, that's rather hard to find.
Well, I wonder there too, if we find such a piece of land somewhere, it was thought that the coastal range, I think, and what we call Anwar was that place. Mm-hmm. It's way the heck up there. It's in the far northwestern corner of the nation.
Yes.
What could be the problem with creating that as wilderness? So I guess the question I have is, even if we decide this plot that we define as wilderness in 1994 or 5 or 6, what about needs in the beginning of the 21st century? I mean, can we... Mm-hmm. Can we tie it down for all time when we don't know what our future is like?
Well, that's an interesting problem because when the Congress set up the wilderness system in 1964, it has created a mechanism to add lands to the wilderness system. I think the premise has been, at least on the part of the people who advocate wilderness preservation, the interest groups, that once a piece of land on the federal estate goes into the wilderness system, it's going to stay there. It's it's there permanently for as long as the United States shall exist. And so to classify an area as wilderness and then at some point think about declassifying it and taking it out is a real red flag to environmental groups because it's the notion that we fought a battle. We've got some land included into the system, and now people are saying, well, now it has a higher use. The nation needs it for a higher purpose than wilderness. It may be oil development or whatever. And so that can be a very controversial kind of thing. In fact, in the boundary waters, one solution to the dispute over motors in the late 70s was to pass a bill which would delete 400,000 acres of the boundary waters from the wilderness system and make it a national recreation area in which multiple uses were allowed, and then take the other 600,000 core wilderness and make that a pure wilderness with no non-conforming uses. Mm-hmm. And a lot of environmental groups in Minnesota didn't go for that because that would have been the first time since 1964 that land would have been delisted, taken out of a wilderness status, out of the system. Unhappy thing for many people to happen.
Mm-hmm. Jim Gladden is our guest today on Conversations. As you're talking, I'm wondering about ANWR and other issue areas in Alaska. Do we have our boundary water canoe area battles going on now under our feet?
Oh, I think we really do, in the sense that I think many Alaskans believe that the federal government is unnecessarily constraining the future economic prosperity of the state because of, the Alaska Lands Act of 1980, the amount of land that was put into conservation status. And so, yeah, I think that we see this sort of conflict between a state and the national level, if you will, or between a particular group of people in a location and then a larger group of people around them. I think that the basic conflict of economic development versus environmental protection is being played out here in Alaska. Little doubt about that.
What can we learn from boundary waters? If you were to advise people as a political scientist from your experience watching boundary waters, what's happening there that we should not repeat here?
Well, I think in terms of wilderness, at least in my view, perhaps that area shouldn't have been included as part of wilderness, at least to the extent of the acreage, because it built in problems. There was a history of multiple use. And I think in the case of Alaska, that there's a difference in land use in wilderness in Alaska and the lower 48, because the 1964 Wilderness Act basically prohibits any sort of mechanized travel, whereas Alaska has a unique situation because I believe the Alaska Lands Act created 56 million acres of land into the wilderness preservation system. Mm-hmm. It also allowed rural residents to use mechanized equipment to transport themselves for subsistence purposes.
Why did it do that?
Well, I think it did that in part because that was an established use. In other words, when the Act was passed in 1980, those kinds of ways of travel had become, we would call them, standard. Just as at one point, traveling on foot or by dog sled or by boat and paddle were standard ways to get around the country. By 1980, you had these different kinds of ways of traveling, mechanized ways. And I always found that, on the one hand, very reasonable that sort of, if you will, concession was made in establishing wilderness in Alaska. On the other hand, it could be potentially a problem into the future. What if at some point people in various groups believed that mechanized use for subsistence ought to be curtailed or maybe even in some places eliminated, certain national parks or wildlife refuges? To me, that would be a virulent replay of the boundary waters in terms of very hard feelings on both sides as to what ought to happen.
Mm-hmm. But we can't take that back, right?
I don't think we can. on the other hand, I would say in case of the boundary waters, when the boundary waters was included in the Wilderness Act in 1964, the way it happened was that the local multiple-use people and the preservationists compromised, and the local people said, we will relent and not oppose the inclusion of the boundary waters into the system on the condition that multiple uses remain, status quo remains, which is a contradiction because you're logging and you're using motorized recreation. Well, that was the deal that Senator Hubert Humphrey, who sponsored the bill, worked out with the various parties. And then when the issue was reconsidered, when the political balance of power changed between the interest groups by the 1970s, environmental groups came back and decided that motors just really didn't belong in the boundary waters, and so proposed legislation in the Congress that would basically delete the 4D5 provision of the Wilderness Act and thereby eliminate logging and motorized recreation. And so I think a lot of local people believe that was a broken promise. That was an unfair kind of thing to do. And I guess I have mixed feelings about that, because in a democracy, values and interest and relative positions of strength shift over time. And so what may not be possible politically at one point in time may be at another. And to say that we make a deal at one point in time which is in perpetuity may be... isn't the way the American political system works.
But it does seem to be one of our values, which is interesting. We shook on this. We we made this our deal, and now you've reneged. Mm-hmm. You must be. Well, I don't want to say un-American, but you are definitely challenging our values. Jim Gladden is with us today on Conversations, and we're talking about wilderness and the different ways Americans in 1993, 4, 5, at the end of the 20th century, value this concept of wilderness and what we want to do with it. Jim Gladden is a political scientist. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He is, has twice, to my knowledge, been acknowledged as one of the best faculty members on campus, once by students and another time by the faculty at UAF. He's received several grants, a number of awards, among which a Fulbright grant to travel to Nigeria to lecture there. Jim Gladden, our guest today on Conversations. I want to ask what is the naive question, and that is, can this system of negotiating wilderness values ever be pure and painless? Is it always going to be one of loggerheads and embattled values and consequently hurt feelings?
Yeah, I think it would depend on how far down the road we want to look.
Okay.
It could be that over time we as a people, as a race, could develop technology in such a way that we could use land with hardly any sort of ecological impact, maybe even without an aesthetic impact. It could be at some point, if we talk about a collision of old and new values, old, we'll call them economic development values, and new environmental protection values, if we're working through, I think, during the 19th century or the 20th century, the earlier part, the sense of economic development was the prime directive of the country. That's what we were going to do with nature. And now in the late 20th century, there is an environmental consciousness, and there is an awareness of the biological nature of human beings and some level our dependence upon nature. So it seems to me that at some point in the future, that these kind of things might not be controversial, because the economics and the technology of the nation would have shifted in such a way that people would be in fundamental agreement about those values. It wouldn't be a culture caught in conflict between two different ways of viewing land. And people at a local level wouldn't be penalized economically if an area close to where they lived were put in some sort of highly protective land use category.
They're going to be immediate. In the immediate, there are going to be losses then, and that's the economic stability of a community that is building its economic base on nature in some way. And then the other side, which means that there are going to be species of trees or animals or ecological systems that will be lost as we try and battle this out. Is that part of the immediate future you see?
I think, Susan, I think what needs to go on is that we need, as a people, to design a way of life in which we fit in the way nature works. People have talked about a steady state economy, a so-called homeostatic society, one in which we have an ability to restrain our need for resources. So I think we need to move in the long term to some sort of balance between humans and nature. And to do that, I think we have to look at nature in fundamentally different terms than the way we do now, that somehow there's this dichotomy between the human species on the one hand and the rest of nature on the other. We have to, I think, as Aldo Leopold, look at ourselves as inside nature, as a part of nature, as having some sort of duty to act in certain ways toward nature for our self-interest and for an ethical reason. And I think we're not talking about sacrificing a quality of life. We're not talking about going back to a Stone Age economy. We're probably talking about a very sophisticated technology, people with a high level of education and understanding. But we're probably also talking about to be in some sort of functional harmony with nature, we're talking about a lot fewer people than the number of people we have on the planet today. But that may be a bit utopian, that sort of view. But I think I see no reason why humans can't design a preferred future in which we fit in with nature, but that doesn't mean we can't live highly, lives of high quality with a good economic structure, one which people would feel satisfied with.
Okay. Here's a hard question, and I'm still in the immediate. I watch you going down the road into the future, and I'm following you with interest, but I'm wondering how many of us are walking along. So the question is, at this point in our time, how ready do you think we are as a culture to make that step?
It seems to me that we aren't very far in that direction, and that's perhaps why I said the word utopian.
Yes.
I think that we are in America in some sort of transition of thinking about environment, but I think we're a long ways from agreement, just in terms of establishing a threshold, what level of development ought to go on in the United States on public lands. I think there's going to be a lot of controversy about that for a long time. It used to be in the 19th century with the robber barons that no one even thought twice about ripping through resources, maybe in a highly inefficient way. And then Guilford Pinchot came along with the progressive conservationist and said, well, we need to use nature, but we need to do so in a scientific, quasi-scientific way, sustained yield. And then the environmental movement came along with an ecological focus and said, well, that's really not quite the way we want to do it either, because you're looking at nature as just a complex of natural resources, and nature is ecological connection. And so we have these shifting awarenesses of land and how we ought to use it. And I would like to think that at some point there would be consensus among people in this country about the way we ought to relate to nature. There'd be some sort of public policy consensus, if you will.
Where is America? Where are Americans relative to the rest of the world? You and I have spoken about your Fulbright period in Nigeria, and your sense is that Nigerians have a very different point of view about the land they stand on than do we. And I don't know where Nigeria would fit on a scale, or where Americans would fit on a scale of transformation, which is what you're talking about. So where do you place us in the world?
I would place Americans along with perhaps Western Europeans as probably about as far along as you can get in terms of a changed attitude toward nature, toward human-environment relations. And I say that because we are among the wealthiest countries in the world. We have, in a sense, become wealthy by going through our industrial revolution. And I think because we have a large middle class in this country, because we have a fairly high level of education and an awareness of the world, I think Americans are a privileged people on this planet, at least at this point in time. And we have, we're probably in the forefront of people who have some level of changed consciousness about nature. I think a lot of it has to do with, if you look at Africa, for example, in Nigeria, it was clear to me in Nigeria that the Nigerians are going through or trying to move toward an industrial revolution, trying to mechanize agriculture and build more factories and that kind of thing. They've developed their oil fields to a significant extent. But I think that the average person in Nigeria doesn't have what we in the West would call an environmental consciousness or concern about wildlife protection or staking off an area of land and letting nature pretty much decide what goes on in that area as opposed to human effects. And again, I guess I would classify it in terms of industrial revolution, what countries have been through it and those that haven't, and trying to answer that kind of question.
Mm-hmm. Are we going to have to figure out ways to educate the world to our way of thinking? That is to say, do you think this way of thinking is the future and the world must come along?
Well, on some broader level, I would like to think that. Of course, you always run into the problem that we Americans went through our Industrial Revolution by developing wilderness lands. Right. And then we talk to the Brazilians or to other third world people and say, well, you ought not to do this kind of thing to your land because it's going to have an ecological impact, which will affect not only you, but the rest of the world. And Brazilians and other people are inclined to say, that's really not fair because look what you did to your land base to get to where you're at, and now you're telling us we can't do that. So are we to freeze in time our economic development while you already have yours? It creates a bit of a problem.
Which means that we're all going to be moving along at different paces, and some folks in the world way behind and may never get to a point, and there may be parts of the world that just burn out on industrialization? Question mark?
I think quite possibly.
Yeah, quite possibly. I want to reintroduce Jim Gladden to you. Our guest today on Conversations has focused his academic study on wilderness values. His dissertation resulted in a book called The Boundary Waters Canoe Area, Wilderness Values and Motorized Recreation. It emerged from Iowa State University Press in Ames in 1990. It is a book that's available at the University of Alaska Rasmussen Library. His two dozen or more academic papers have looked at politics, ethics, and changing or unchanging values as they relate to wilderness use. He's looked at subsistence politics and the animal rights movement. He's looked at the wreck of the Exxon Valdez and other issues. Jim Gladden has written about politics, literature, agriculture, and other rural development in Nigeria, as well as in the United States. And on a theoretical level, his subjects have been biocentrism and anthropocentrism, both of which we've talked about indirectly today, and how a democracy confronts values and changing values. Jim Gladden, our guest today on Conversation, we're taking a look at the wilderness and how we look at it. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. You used a word and a concept a couple of minutes ago that I kind of mentally marked and I want to come back to. You talked about a homeostatic economy. If I understand what that means, and I'll ask you to define it to make sure we do, but if I understand what that means, isn't that a notion that panics American business. If homeostatic mm-hmm. means the straight line, I think it does. All our efforts as participants in an economy have been to, as our current president says, grow the economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that it's a basic challenge to the way that Americans and private enterprise understand what we ought to be doing. Any president in office wants to make the claim that the real rate of growth of the economy is occurring during his administration.
At least 3%, if not more.
Yes. Right. And so I think a lot of people feel that a steady state economy is really a type of heresy, because we're doing away with this notion of expansion and growth, material progress, which I think that Americans and other people hold near and dear. I think that's part of the modern nation-state world, that kind of thing. I again think that's a real problem. I don't know in my own mind how to reconcile private enterprise with a homeostatic society. I really think there ought to be a number of ways to do that. The entrepreneurial spirit ought to be able to be captured in a sustainable economy, in a so-called post-industrial society, this sort of, if you will, competitive urge, an urge for excellence in terms of making products and that kind of thing. Maybe we could talk in a homeostatic society about a qualitative improvement of the human condition as opposed to a quantitative improvement. Mm. And so instead of more buildings and more people and more highways and so forth and so on, more quantity, we could focus more on quality. Maybe producing transport systems which are non-polluting and which have minimum impact upon the ecosystems through which they operate. So again, I don't think there's necessarily an incompatibility, but I think a lot of people in the United States look upon the environmental movement as they look upon it with a suspicion that the values of the movement are antithetical to the traditions of the country. Private enterprise, you can do what you want, and that sort of notion.
Mm-hmm. Now, the same question then on this new subject. How ready do you see kind of state-of-the-art American entrepreneurs, kind of the R&D women and men of this country, mm-hmm. how prepared do you think that group of people are to make that paradigm shift, not quantity but quality?
I think a lot of that has to do with the incentive that people have, and I think that if you have people in private enterprise who are able to design some sort of technology to prevent pollution in the first place, and there's a market for that, then I think that private enterprise could use its genius in ways that would be environmentally beneficial, that would help to, in a sense, insert us back into nature. I mean, I think that's what happened to us. We, at one point, we were almost on an unconscious level in nature, let's say in Neolithic times or Paleolithic times, and we've taken ourselves out of nature as an intellectual proposition and a technological proposition. And now I think we are, on some level, attempting to reinsert ourselves back into nature, only with, in a sense, what we learned when we were out of nature,
yes.
To the sense that we can then live cooperatively with nature, and yet on a very high level of self-awareness of what we are as human.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting concept. We stepped out and now are trying to figure out how to get back in.
Yeah.
Tell me if you think this is an appropriate time to ask this question. I have a curiosity about what deep ecology is, and as a movement and as a philosophy. Does that move out of that question?
Yeah, I think it does. I think the deep ecologist is someone who challenges the basic set of views that we now have in the West about nature, the notion that nature is one thing and humans are another, that nature is simply an instrument or a means toward whatever ends we have. I think that's part of deep ecology is again the notion that if you're a deep ecologist, you see yourself as one of many life forms. You don't see yourself as a distinct entity outside of everything else. And you use technology as a fulcrum to manipulate and control nature for your particular interest. I think that's a part of deep ecology. It's the notion of believing in some sort of moral duty on the part of people toward the rest of that which inhabits the planet, other kinds of life forms. Whereas people talk about the shallow ecologist,
okay.
And these are supposed to be the people in the mainstream environmental movement, Sierra Club, for example, the people who basically want to work inside the system to change the way that the government and the society relates to nature, but according to the deep ecologists, do not challenge the fundamental premises of the system, of the establishment. And so the deep ecologists say to really modify and get to a new future, we've got to step outside of trying to reform the system and work within the system, step outside the established way of operation and go in another direction altogether.
I want to ask the... It's a question that makes me laugh. Does the deep ecologist say rocks have rights? And then do rocks have rights?
I think that a deep ecologist would relate pretty closely to the view of animism, that all things are imbued with some spirit, some genius. And so I think that probably the deep ecologist would say that both biotic and abiotic entities have soul or spirit or consciousness, if you will, and they would probably go back to maybe Eastern religion or Native American religion and point to traditional beliefs and that sort of thing.
Right.
In my own case, somehow it doesn't make sense to me to think that a rock has any level of moral standing or consciousness. I think that a human can use a rock in such a way that if the use of that rock doesn't damage other life forms or an ecological balance, then I don't see any problem with that approach to things.
But there does need to be extended some respect for the place of the rock in the universe. Not necessarily not doing something because the rock is there, but understanding what the rocks... And maybe this, maybe we should say this is gold rather than... when we think of the word rock, it's different than if we think of the word gold, but they're both kind of rocks. So
yeah.
let's give it something that has value to us.
Well, maybe another way to get at this, if you think of the moon... that surrounds the Earth, that goes around the Earth, there isn't any life that we know of on the moon. And so if a mineral company were to go to the moon and mine an ore, presumably it wouldn't do, no matter what it did to the moon's surface, it wouldn't have any sort of impact on life. My way of thinking is unclear on the matter as to whether we have any sort of we ought to treat abiotic matter in a certain way. I would only view it in relation to the way we treat biotic matter.
Okay.
But beyond that, it wouldn't make... clearly, if you want to use those kind of terms, the way we treat air has an effect upon other life forms, ourselves included. But to say that air has any sort of moral standing is something that personally I don't make sense of. But I think a lot of deep ecologists would say yes, that everything has some sort of energy or spirit or standing, and that we are bound to fit within it and respect it.
What would a deep ecologist say about using a motorboat in the Boundary Waters canoe area, or an ATV to mm-hmm. hunt in interior Alaska?
Yeah, I think probably a deep ecologist would say, in the case of the Boundary Waters, that machines don't belong in places like that. That a machine is a symbol of human control or domination of nature. There ought to be areas in which this kind of equipment, this kind of artifact, isn't allowed. And so my sense is that they would seek to remove that kind of transport from those kinds of areas as inappropriate.
If we were to go hunting, could we? Where do we stop and start? Do we take our gun? Do we take our snow machine? Do we take our motorboat in the summertime? What?
It's. I guess it depends on how far you want to push the issue. With a deep ecologist, my sense of the matter is there's an aesthetic involved in the use of motors. By that I mean a lot of people who go into a classified wilderness area have an anticipation of a machine-free environment, and so they are offended or irritated when they encounter the sound or the sight of motorized equipment. But the point is that many of these kinds of machines have negligible ecological effect on the way that nature works in a given land area. And so it comes down to the question of, I guess, aesthetics and what we view as appropriate.
Aesthetics, that's interesting, because that's not something we've talked about before, but you think that's an important factor, as something we have to consider as human beings as well.
Well, I really think, at least politically, that's an issue. In the case of the Boundary Waters, it intrigued me, the motorized recreation issue intrigued me, because the people who wanted the motors removed did not object to them on grounds of science and biology and ecology. The equipment really didn't have that much impact on the biophysical environment, and so the environmentalists didn't really make their case on that. They'd rather said that this sort of artifact, this machine, is not appropriate as an idea, as a concept in wilderness. Wilderness and machines don't fit together well. Their view of aesthetics and of the harmony of nature would be disrupted by an encounter with a machine. That would break the play in their mind, the reason for which they went into the wilderness to have a certain kind of mental experience, a certain expectation fulfilled, would be shattered or frustrated by an encounter with a machine. It would break the aesthetic, the beauty of the moment and what they're trying to capture when they go into these kind of areas.
It feels to me, when I hear you talking about this argument, that this would just grate like a cheese grater against the nerves of people who feel that their aesthetic involves the motorboat, the snow machine, the...
Oh, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
In fact, in the case of the Boundary Waters, the local people who wanted to use motorboats were very angry because they believed they were being asked to sacrifice economic benefits and their particular preference.
Yes.
Their preference was to use a motor to go into the wilderness to fish for the day or picnic with the family and come back out. They believed the environmentalists were being unreasonable and selfish, because what they basically wanted to do was remove these people from their preferred form of recreation.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, is this issue resolved in Minnesota?
Basically, it is. The 1978 Act reduced the water surface area for motorized recreation from about 60% to 30%. There were some law cases, some lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of the act by the multiple use people, but that died down and went away by 1994. The managers of that area are now writing another management plan, and they're looking to restrict the size of parties that go into the boundary waters. Mm-hmm. And that's becoming controversial because local outfitters and other people who gain commerce from the use of recreation in the boundary waters don't want these kinds of limits put upon the amount of business they can do. So there is some controversy over that. But the logging issue was settled some time ago in 1978. The area is completely off limits to logging now. And so
this debate, whether it's in Minnesota or Alaska, is just going to go on probably as long as we all live, those of us here in the audience and discussion today, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think that in particular in the western United States, mm-hmm. Where the public lands are, and even more so the state of Alaska, where so much of our land is in public ownership, and so requires a legislative decision and a public agency to manage the policy. I think that these kinds of issues will be a long time in going away, be with us for a long time.
Jim Gladden, thanks very much. It's been an interesting hour.
Thank you.
We've been talking about wilderness with Professor Jim Gladden. One or two final introductions of Jim Gladden to us. In 1992, he kind of continued his professorial service in Nigeria. A United States Information Service grant took him to Lagos, where he was the guest speaker in Lagos and Ibadan, both in Nigeria. That's June of 1992. I mentioned he was chosen outstanding faculty. That was in 89-90, the academic year, by the Associated Students of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's a member of the National Political Science Honor Society, Pi Sigma Alpha, and exchanges with another professor in the political science department the leadership, the guidance of the local chapter at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Jim Gladden, our guest today on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you tune in again next week. Thanks again, Jim.
Thank you.